And once again, it's time for another edition of Rock in the Boat here on Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. My name's the V-Man, and on today's program, we'll be talking with Carrie Lamprecht and Ashley McNamara, two members of a unique collective called the Icarus Project, a nonprofit, community-based support network and underground media project created by and for people struggling with bipolar disorder and other dangerous gifts that are commonly labeled as mental illness. They'll be joining me by telephone to discuss their work on creating non-authoritarian, non-hierarchical, non-professionally based peer support groups for people with or without diagnosis, and how people can help to organize outside of the psych wards for their own mental well-being. That'll be coming up shortly. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat, coming up next on Freak Radio 101 FM. That was Jimi Hendrix getting us started off here with Manic Depression. My name's the V-Man. This is Rockin' the Boat. According to figures from the National Mental Health Association, more than 54 million Americans have a mental disorder in any given year, with fewer than 8 million seeking treatment. Depression and anxiety disorders, the two most common mental illnesses, affect 19 million American adults each annually. In any given year, more than 2 million American adults, or about 1% of the population age 18 and older, have bipolar disorder, also known as manic depressive illness, a brain disorder that causes unusual shifts in a person's mood, energy, and ability to function. Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll be discussing problems with the mental health industry, touching on some of the common diagnoses people have, and associated issues from those quote-unquote disorders. Joining me via telephone are Carrie Lamprecht and Ashley McNamara, two members of a unique collective called the Icarus Project, a nonprofit community-based support network and underground media project created by and for people struggling with bipolar disorder and other dangerous gifts that are commonly labeled as mental illness. The Icarus Project aims to create non-authoritarian, non-hierarchical, non-professionally based peer support groups for people with or without diagnosis and help people organize outside of the psych wards for their own mental well-being. I want to welcome you both, Carrie and Ashley, to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thanks for having us.
No problem. And I guess I just wanted to distinguish your voices. I'm speaking with Ashley now?
Yeah, you're speaking with Ashley.
Okay, great. Maybe we can begin by having you just describe a little bit of your own history, to whatever degree you're comfortable with, your own history with mental health, with the mental health profession, and maybe describe some of your experiences having bipolar, quote-unquote, disorder.
Sure. Well, I mean, one thing that was interesting for me listening to the introduction that you gave was just the kind of language that you had to use in order to present the official viewpoint on mental health, and particularly, you know, I move in circles these days where I don't normally talk about myself as someone who has manic depressive illness or a brain disease or dysfunction. And that to me, that discrepancy points to a lot of why we are doing the Icarus Project. I mean, I'm someone who throughout my entire life has been an extremely sensitive and extremely volatile person. Ever since I was a little kid, there's no doubt in my mind that I popped into the world, you know, a bit on the thin skin side and very sensitive. But it wasn't until I was 19 and depressed to the point of complete incapacitation that I actually received a label. And up to that point, I understood what happened to me as something that was dramatic and difficult and devastating and amazing and not necessarily something that fit within a specific category. And then when I was 19 years old, I got what they would say is really manic and spent a month of my life completely convinced that if I could teach everyone in America that the cells that make up our bodies were born in the supernovas of stars 15 billion years ago, that everybody would understand that we are all the same, there should be no injustice, and we could all get along in peace and harmony forever. And I was like living and breathing this idea, you know, 24 hours a day without really needing to sleep very much and completely obsessed. And at the time, it just seemed obvious to me that I was obviously incredibly brilliant and everybody else was incredibly deluded that they were not jumping on my bandwagon. And, you know, this is extremely upsetting. And then I crashed terribly after that and became depressed for months to the point that I really couldn't take care of myself and didn't know what day it was, didn't sleep, didn't really, you know, excuse me, all I did was sleep. I didn't really eat. I just was a zombie. And at the time, the woman that I was dating basically was the only person taking care of me. And at a certain point, she couldn't take care of me anymore. And I ended up getting put into a couple psych wards. And I mean, one thing that experience points to me is just how little support there is for so many people who deal with mental health problems in our society. I mean, for me at the time, I was a really unhappy college student. I really wanted to not be living the life I was living, not be living the place I was living. But there were no options made available to me that I could actually make changes in my life. You know, dropping out of school was not something I was supposed to do. Moving was not something I was supposed to do. And I had no support network. I've pretty well alienated any friends that I did have, which is something that's pretty common to a lot of people with mental health struggles. And so there were no options for me, and the only option that existed in Providence, Rhode Island, was a psych ward and doctors and a bunch of medication. And that is pretty much the standard treatment that people get in our country when they go through extreme emotional experiences. And at this point in my life, I'm largely because of the Icarus Project, I have a really different way of understanding what happens with myself. I'm not in denial that I am bipolar as an adjective in terms of that it describes the fact that I go dramatically up and dramatically down if I don't take care of myself. I don't believe that mental health problems don't exist at all or that they're completely a figment of industrialized society. You know, people have been, the term mania was coined by the ancient Greeks thousands of years ago. Like, these sorts of experiences have existed in the human psyche for a long time. However, I don't believe that I have a pathological brain disorder, and that it's just like diabetes and that I need insulin for the rest of my life, you know, and insulin for someone with a psychiatric problem is, you know, lithium or some other kind of medication. I don't buy into that paradigm as being the only way to understand my struggles. And it's that perspective that is what led us to form the Icarus Project. My friend Sasha, who I started the project with in 2002, wrote an article called The Bipolar World that was published in the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And it was about that very paradox, about recognizing that there are extremely disruptive and difficult things that happen to you if you don't take care of yourself, but not wanting to label those things within the matrix of bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness, not wanting to believe that you have to take medication for the rest of your life, and feeling really caught between, in his case, an anti-authoritarian community that did not, for the most part, want to acknowledge that mental illness even existed as anything other than an oppressive construct, and then mainstream America that would say the answer to everybody's problems is to swallow Prozac, you know. And he wrote this article, and at the time, I'd never met him, and I'd never read anything like it, and it resonated so much with the problems that I faced myself every day that I ended up sending him my entire life story by email. And when we met, it turned out that dozens of people were sending him their stories, and that there were people all over the country who had the same experience, both that part of what got pathologized in them was the most brilliant, creative, expansive part, the part that they call mania, which has its ugly sides and also gives a lot of us the ability to be incredibly creative and visionary and really challenge the systems that exist in the world and see outside them. But then to know that somehow that part that involves the flying too close to the sun, is the flip side of the depression and the hysteria and the panic and the psychosis and the paranoia and all of the horrible things that happen when someone crashes. And when we met and he showed me all these letters he'd been receiving from people, we really wanted there to be some way for these people to find each other. And, you know, we thought about what if when we were 15, if we could have read these people's words and we could have known that we weren't actually alone. We thought we were totally alone. And so we decided to start a website, which originally was going to be a really modest endeavor, just a place to house these particular letters, and that was it. And it ended up just taking off, and people were really excited about it, and we ended up compiling people's writing and self-publishing a book called Navigating the Space Between Brilliance and Madness, which is now in its fourth printing, and doing workshops about mental health, and now the Icarus Project has grown to the point where we actually are, there's a collective of six people who sort of run things behind the scenes with the help of a lot of volunteers, but the project itself really is made up of thousands of people all over the country. And Carrie is someone who's come into the project in the past few months and has become one of our core people that's helping us out. And it's been really incredible to have people really join in solidarity behind struggles that we've had in private for so long and now to be working together on really trying to create the changes that we want to see happen in the world.
That's Ashley McNamara, one of the co-founders of the Icarus Project. I'd like to bring in Carrie Lamprecht. Maybe if you would also just kind of describe your own history with being bipolar and what that's been like for you and how this brought you to kind of to a peer support group such as the Icarus Project, and maybe just give us a sense of what it's like, some of the ups and downs for you.
Well, for me, I would describe my childhood as being very it was like a roller coaster. I remember crying uncontrollably for hours and hours and hours about the fact that kids in Ethiopia couldn't have enough food, and I just didn't understand how that can happen and how people could walk around in the world and not see these things that I saw and felt with every cell of my body. And I also knew that when I closed my eyes and I played music or I painted or I did some of the things that expressed this other, like, very intense side of myself, that people cried and were touched, and And this kind of gift of too much sensitivity allowed me to open portals for other people to see through and create ways in which transcend the fact that, you know, what I was experiencing was perhaps, you know, a little too intense for myself at times. So I had a very tumultuous kind of teenage years, and I also, when I was 19, had my first major episode where it felt like my brain chemistry actually changed, and it did in a way, and I was just like, all of a sudden, I couldn't move, I couldn't get up, I couldn't care for myself. I was so deeply depressed and so, like, zombie-like. I was actually in a catatonic state where I was I just stopped registering other people around me or the need to get up and eat or anything like that. It was quite dramatic, and it went on for weeks and weeks, and I was living with my family at the time, and my family doesn't subscribe to, you know, the fact that mental illnesses can be incapacitating or they're in, you know, the fact that you need help and guidance through different situations, because that might mean that you didn't have all the answers and you needed outside help. And that was a pretty scary concept, which I think a lot of people, you know, like especially parents, don't want to see their children going through such turmoil. So it's really easy just to kind of slip into patterns of behavioral denial. So that's another issue that comes up for a lot of folks that are later diagnosed around 18 to 20 years of age, when a lot of major psychoses kind of try to rear their heads into our adult lives. This is the age that's most common for people to start showing bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and other disorders. I had to be hospitalized, and I was astonished being so incapacitated, but then going into a hospital where all that happened to me was that I was drugged out of my mind so that I was drooling, and it was a horrible, dehumanizing, undignified experience, which made me realize how much I couldn't trust anyone. And it made me feel that much more subjugated to the humiliation involved, the societal kind of views of mental illness. It was the most unhealthy treatment and the most unsane, insane treatment that could be offered for someone going through a crisis. And I came to realize that that's the average experience that people have when they go into hospitalization, they go into treatment facilities, because all of your choices and your freedoms and your decisions all get tossed away, and you become oppressed by terminology, behavioral patterns, and drug side effects. And a lot of the things on the edges of our personalities that make us the most vibrant and alive are taken away or kind of sanded down on the edges, and the drugs will take hold. And yes, I've had to adapt to being on medication and accept the fact that I can't walk through life in my kind of normal disposition, because it's too much for me. If I want to live the life I do, I take medication. And at the Icarus Project, it's really amazing to see we can talk about that. We can talk about the people who choose to take medication, and we can also talk about all the options that you have not taking medication. And that's something I never saw before. And I'm really, like, overjoyed at being able to be a part of a collective that honors both of those things and that really puts such a heavy emphasis on self-determination. So, you know, we will have conversations on the website and information about medications and allow people to talk about their medications, what works for them, what doesn't, types of side effects. Or my doctor told me this, and my doctor told me that. Is that really what is going on? And have some dialogue about these things that are so heavy taboo in our society, and have a swap of information that's based in mutual aid and kind of like, oh, well, we're all going to be, we're in the same boat, so we might as well help each other out here and like kind of tread these waters together. And that's something that I really identify with, is the concept of we're in this together and that solidarity. And I see that those are the types of things working on the Icarus Project that really resonate with people. And people now, I'm working with the Icarus Project, and people are like, you are? That is so great. And it's because there's this excitement about the fact that there's not one way of looking at the world. There's a million ways. And the beauty is in the diversity. And I think that if we celebrate our own individualities and our own beautifulness in all its, you know, crazy crevices, the crooked mind, or, you know, it's amazing and beautiful. And so in solidarity, I think people can find ways to liberate themselves and to accept all the things that are considered abnormalities as being beautiful gifts. So I joined the Icarus Project a couple months ago, and I met Sasha and Ashley at a book reading about a year and a half ago. I went to see them speak about their book, Navigating the Space Between Brilliance and Madness. And the book event was at AK Press, and a circle of people came into the room, and I was expecting, oh, we're going to hear about a book. But it became a discussion with everyone involved about our experiences with mental health and our experiences. The people who had all been drawn into that room were all folks that had a perspective that was different than the Western kind of ideology of you take this pill and shut up, and you're going to live with this illness the rest of your life and have to take medication, end of statement. These people were like, no, there's something else out there that I want to know about, I want to hear about. And then reading Sasha and Ashley's words, and talking about the horrible parts, the wonderful, amazing parts, all of the stuff in between, like, it was amazing to hear. And to hear someone be so candid about things that are so hush-hush, and to be able to say, I can actually talk about this stuff, too, about myself, because these people are exposing that deep, dark stuff. You know, and so people were like, yes, I, too, grew up with this. I had this happen to me, and we're able to come forward one by one in the room and really talk about some hard stuff. And I was astounded. I was really astounded. So Ashley and Sasha asked me to write a piece in the upcoming book, a manual for communities for folks in their communities to be able to put together kind of grassroots, really comfortable types of non-authoritative, peer-based support for each other. And I was so ecstatic, and I loved writing the piece, and it was about some research I've done in the past working in institutions with different forms of peer-based, anti-authoritarian, anti-professionally based support groups that were by far more effective than any other treatment that I had been a part of in my history as a counselor in homes for emotionally, quote-unquote, disturbed youth or youth offenders. And it was the most dignified and the most liberating form of treatment that I had ever seen. And the patients that I was working with, and I say with, not I was working on or something, I really saw each of these, this test group using this method that we had come across and kind of come up with organically. A few other members of the staff and I, we saw these kids grow into human beings with compassion, which is something that you can't instill in people through authoritarian methods, because it takes away the choice or the respect involved for someone to want to listen and care and care about someone else. And so these are the types of ideas we're starting to work with in the Icarus Project, in some of the writing we're doing, and we're going to be working on coming up with some forms of group therapy that are based on consensus and self-determination and allowing folks that are labeled in different ways or not to be able to come together and have kind of a structure to follow, but be able to make that their own and really take it from there and see what happens.
Again, you're tuned into Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. My name's the V-Man, and I'm joined today by two members of the Icarus Project. Ashley McNamara, could you...
Hey,
hi.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that a little louder? We're having trouble hearing you all of a sudden.
Sure. I was just going to ask you maybe if you could talk a little bit about the founding of the Icarus Project and just give us a little history of, you know, why you chose the name... It comes from Greek mythology, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm happy to tell you about that. So the first night that Sasha and I ever met in person, we were sitting in my room, and he told me how he'd become obsessed with the metaphor of Icarus as a metaphor for manic depression. And the myth of Icarus is one of the oldest Greek myths, and it's about a boy and his father who are trapped in a maze on an island, and they're trying to escape, and there's no way out. And then the father, who's an inventor, realizes that he can make them wings out of wax and feathers. And so he gives his son these wings, and he says, now you can fly away with these, but be very careful. If you fly too close to the sun, the wax will melt, and your wings will fall apart, and you'll fall into the ocean and die. So you need to be careful and not fly too high. But of course, you know, the boy puts on his wings and is completely intoxicated with his ability to fly and flies too close to the sun and crashes into the ocean and drowns. And a few months before we started the Icarus Project, Sasha had a friend who was a really radiant member of the activist community who was bipolar and who didn't believe in the diagnosis and didn't believe in medications and had resisted them for years. And she ended up jumping off a bridge and killing herself. And it was an incredible wake-up call to a lot of people in that community that this is an issue that we really need to be talking about. And at the time, he wrote a piece of writing about her called Too Close to the Sun, and using the metaphor that she was this incredibly beautiful person who had so many wonderful things and so much energy, but also was addicted to flying too close to the sun and ended up destroying herself, and that it was so tragic. And so when we met and he talked to me about that metaphor of Icarus and feeling like that resonated so much with the cycle that so many people who are labeled manic depressive go through of getting flying up to great heights and seeing all kinds of beautiful visions and getting addicted to the power and then crashing into the depths of despair and then flying and then crashing and then flying and crashing. And when we decided to start the website the next day, it was just sort of an automatic thing. We were like, well, what are we going to call it? We were like, the Icarus Project, and it just stuck. And we went on the internet and decided to get an Icarus Project at Yahoo email address so that we could start doing something with it. And that was the beginning.
Maybe I would like to hear more about this idea, the concept of mutual aid, and how that can sort of help people who are struggling with a lot of these sort of feelings, and, you know, how is it transformative in terms of dealing with other folks who are going through who are dealing with similar issues?
Okay. So you're asking me how is the experience of mutual aid transformative to people in dealing with their mental health?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, to give you an example that's very close to home, I'll just talk about my own experience for a minute, which is that before starting the Icarus Project, I didn't talk about being bipolar. I was off medication at the time and very much, I don't know if I would say in denial, but it was not an active discussion that happened in my life. People who were in my life at the time, most of them had only known me for 6 months or a year, and none of them had ever seen me when I was really crazy. And, you know, I'd mentioned to the closest people that, you know, I'd been in hospitals and that this was something, you know, I'd dealt with, but no one really believed it. And it was pretty ironic because when we started the Icarus Project, I was very manic and off medicine, which is, you know, a lot of what gave me the energy to teach myself how to write websites 16 hours a day. But when I crashed, no one knew how to take care of me because I hadn't been having these conversations with my friends. And my roommates would actually sneak onto the computer late at night and read the Icarus Project and read all the writing I had been posting during my weeks of mania to find out what the hell was happening to me. And since then, because I do this project, it's come to be something that I talk about constantly. I mean, now everywhere I go, I'm known as, like, Ashley, the Icarus Project girl. You know, everyone knows I'm bipolar. It's well publicized in thousands of editions. And it's been a really interesting thing to see how having that kind of open dialogue has really changed my own relationship to my struggles. I used to feel really stigmatized if I described myself as manic or as depressed. I used to feel like there was something really wrong with me for having these patterns, and I didn't want to admit them to people, and I didn't want them to be part of my reality, whereas now things are so different. You know, it's a common thing for me to come home and be like, yeah, I'm pretty manic right now. I can't go out with you all tonight because I need to stay home and get sleep, because if I don't get sleep, I'm going to get more manic. And that's just a statement. It's not a pathology. It's not something upsetting. It's just, you know, there are parts of my life I look back on and I'm like, wow, yeah, I think I was making some really bad decisions. And a lot of that was because I was experiencing, you know, mania or depression or whatever other unnameable state of chaos. And I don't feel as bad about those things anymore. I feel like I'm able to educate myself and educate other people and have a conversation about these things in a way that liberates me to actually understand my patterns. You know, by naming something, you're able to engage with it in a certain sense in a way that you're not when things are nebulous. So that's one aspect on which I would say that the idea of mutual aid is really helpful in terms of allowing people to start being open about their mental health and therefore starting to understand it better and starting to find out about how other people deal with it and what other people experience. Another level, I would say, is just, I mean, something that we talk about a lot at the Icarus Project is sort of the metaphor of the shaman, which is, you know, sort of a bastardized conglomerated term from anthropology, and there's not really one shaman anywhere, but it's sort of a notion of shamans are generally people within indigenous cultures who are the healing people, and they're people who have the capacity to contact other realms or spirits or other versions of reality and get information and use it for the benefit of their community and to heal people in their community. And a lot of the attributes that are given to shamans by traditional cultures are also attributes that are common to people with mental illness. Most people who are shamans have endured great sickness or suffering or dissolution and have somehow survived and put themselves back together and now have the ability to help other people. And there's a common notion within that world that in order to remain cured, you have to continue to shamanize, that doing that healing work is part of your own cure. And for me and for a lot of the people I know at the Icarus Project, it's very much been true that the work I do in terms of helping other people, in terms of helping people like me feel less alone, in terms of opening up these conversations, in terms of every time I try going off my meds and try a new alternative therapy, I'm doing research for the 4,000 people on the Icarus Project and they all hear about it later. It really has been part of how it's made me so much healthier to feel like the very part of me that is so stigmatized by the culture at large is the part of me that I am working together with other people on and creating change. You know, it's an incredibly, to use an overused word, an incredibly empowering thing to feel like you are working side by side with people talking about really difficult things that our culture does not make respectful space for and does not acknowledge the complexity of. And doing that work and participating in that work is incredibly transformative. It makes you realize that you are, you know, I mean, so much of the current mental health paradigm is not about wellness or healing or cures. It's just about staying out of crisis. You know, you get out of a psych ward, what they want to do is give you medicine that will keep you out of the hospital. No one is so interested in, like, you actually living out your dreams and making the things happen that you want to see happen in the world, much less, you know, if you want to talk about, like, revolution, then you're just, like, delusional and psychotic. You know, no one really thinks revolution is possible. And so to come out of being given those kinds of labels and those kinds of limitations on what sort of person you think you're allowed to be, and to discover that actually you can do more than just survive. Actually, you can work side by side with other crazy people and change the world together. Like, that just opens up a whole realm of possibility of what it is to be human and what it is to be human with, quote, mental illness that is not represented in what the doctors and the authorities tell you when they give you a diagnosis.
I'm really intrigued with the Icarus Project and the idea of sort of embracing the madness, quote unquote. You use the term dangerous gifts rather than disorders or dysfunctions or whatever. Why do you think it's important to rewrite the language of the mental health industry?
This is Carrie.
Hi.
I feel like if you look at what is so-called mental illness in our society, you're looking through a lens that's been given to you. And it's given to you by advertising companies, by pharmaceuticals, by a whole list of huge corporations or other interests that are trying to make us fit into boxes and be categorized. And a little quick fix, you know, take this pill, you'll be better. That's part of our society. And so it's no one ever really talks about what happens after you get that label and what really happens when that label becomes you or your personality or this identity that you've known your whole life is labeled all of a sudden wrong and not right, sick, you know. These are really damaging words, and they carry a lot of weight, and I think that they do a lot more destruction than anyone ever really knows. Because once you're labeled as being different or less than someone else, then you start to really think of yourself in those terms. And the models of healing that we have are based on acceptance of what authorities or professionals tell us. And that is part of individualized care at this point in Western kind of medical society. And that's a relationship that's between you and your doctor. And that's all, pretty much. Most people don't have talk therapy. You know, it's not covered by their insurance or whatever. But a doctor's visit where you can sit and get a prescription from your internist or something for Prozac is covered. So talking about the problems is not happening enough, and there's not enough models of people doing anything except for taking that pill the doctor says is going to make it all go away. So we also live in a capitalist society that's one in which there's power over dominance that we're used to, and this is a familiar form. So this is what, you know, like if someone else that knows more than me says that I'm this, then it must be so. You know, like there's this kind of like acceptance that's kind of, you know, ingrained in us. And when you take that model and you realize like, well, that's one person's opinion. Like that's a doctor's opinion that might not even have mental illness, probably doesn't, hasn't ever taken these drugs themselves, and doesn't really, like, know all the ins and outs about me from sitting and talking to them for half an hour twice a month. It's asinine that you know, this type of these assumptions are what our society are run on right now. It's this is the model. So if you take that model and you look at a model of what works in other societies or what's worked in society before this modern age, you see that there's a society that's more interconnected with people making decisions together, discussing things. It's not an individualized, isolatory kind of society where it's just one relationship you're depending on for healing. It's all your relationships you're depending on for healing in your community, and an integrated kind of view of things from lots of different angles and perspectives, including other people in your community that may be going through the same things you are. And in other societies, for example, like in India, when someone is diagnosed with schizophrenia, they kind of know it as, oh, well, you know, well, this person just has different abilities. They have other talents. So they stay in the family and are celebrated for the talents and blessings and all the amazing things they can do instead of being taken from the family, isolated, and put in this place for crazy people that are not fit to walk around and talk about, you know, crazy things or, you know, like, make us all feel like we might be a little crazy too by having them around and being integrated into a community. So in taking these terms and these assumptions of mental illness and the ways in which our society handles them, you can really see that the actual treatment is really immoral and crazy making in itself. And when after you realize these things in society and you see your spot in it, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty hard to see, like, oh gosh, this is a great thing. and by no means, you know, it is. But the things that we say are dangerous gifts really are just that. They're not illnesses or diseases that are like, there's no cure for this one. It's not that way. There's other aspects of what we would say are bipolar tendencies that are truly gifts of connecting to something grander, something more amazing, of feeling empathy and compassion for other people, of sensing things and being observant in ways that other people don't perceive, in the astounding brilliance of intensity that it is to be alive. And, you know, there's pros and cons to that, but as far as my life and my experience is concerned, I embrace both ends of those. And it's taken me many, many years to be able to say that, and be able to say, yeah, people considered me to be someone with a mental disease. I consider myself to be someone with a mental struggle that I'm trying to conquer every day I'm alive. So turning the dialogue and the terminology around is just as important and empowering as trying to see that there's not just one model to be looking at.
You've both commented on the capitalist structure of the mental health industry. I'm wondering if you wanted to comment, you know, do you think it's a profit-driven decision when doctors decide to keep someone in, you know, in a mental health ward or keep someone on medication or... I mean, oftentimes that's how it seems to me, and I'm wondering if you wanted to comment more on that idea.
Sure. Oh, so you asked me to comment on the way that capitalism and profit values are part of what gets people to rely so much on the medication paradigm?
Exactly.
I think that there are a lot of factors in play, and I think one that I want to throw out there, which we haven't addressed, is just that the medications do help a lot of people, and they are not summarily evil, and not all doctors who prescribe medications are pawns of the system, and, you know, not all drug companies are evil money-grubbing bastards, I hope, and, you know, that there is a place for these things. I mean, Carrie's on medication. I'm currently almost off medication. I'm tapering off them, but I still take one medication myself as well as doing natural remedies. So I just want to make it clear that we are not coming from a perspective that there is no place for these things in the world. However, we do come from the place that they are one tool among many other tools. And I think that if you look at it that way, like for instance for me, medication is one tool. Homeopathy is currently my main tool. I also use meditation. I also see an energy healer. I make art. I go out in nature. I do a lot of things. If you look at that perspective, the only part of that perspective that anyone can really make money off of is the medicine part. And I pay my homeopath. The rest of it, there isn't really a profit motive in. And no one's going to do a bunch of studies that really extensively are going to research how, you know, a combination of homeopathy, meditation, and art affects your mental health, because no one has a profit to make off of that. And if you look at the way that the biomedical mental health industry has been evolving, I mean, it really is also, you know, in cahoots with the health insurance industry. And health insurance wants to cover things, it seems to me, that they feel there are studies for that you can measure, quantify, document, research, double blind, placebos, etc., etc. And it's really, really difficult. You know, it used to be that the mental health industry relied a lot more on therapy, and that has its own problematic aspects. You know, like Freudian analysis is not necessarily the most constructive way to understand yourself. But these days, I mean, you know, the standard paradigm is you get dispensed out of the psych ward, you see a psychiatrist, you know, twice a month for 20 minutes, and they give you pills that drastically alter your ability to function in the world and how you perceive it, and that's it. And the medications are, in a lot of ways, for the insurance companies, end up being less expensive than a lot of talk therapy would be, because that requires actual human beings to interact with you. And, you know, the medications suppress a lot of symptoms. I mean, for me, something I'm dealing with right now is that as I've been gone off my lithium and I'm going off my meds, I feel increasingly like I can't live in a city. I feel like the city is very overstimulating to me, and I feel like working with a computer all the time is just not something that fits me. When I'm on a bunch of lithium, however, it feels more reasonable to live in a city and sit in front of a computer. When I'm ingesting these substances once a day that do, to a certain extent, give me filters against modern life so that it doesn't seem as insane, I'm much more able to plug into certain roles within the capitalist matrix. And when those filters are removed, it's a lot harder for me to plug into those roles. And I think that the reliance, I mean, like if you look at, for instance, how meds are being used with kids these days, and you look at how, I mean, I have a lot of friends who are teachers right now within the education system, and they are so appalled at how quickly, if a kid is unruly and doesn't want to sit still and has issues in school, their parents are getting calls telling them that the kid needs to go see a psychiatrist and get put on Ritalin. And this isn't like some leftist conspiracy theory or 1984 novel. This is like the real world that we live in right now. I mean, the incidence of use of antipsychotic medications and other serious psychiatric medications on children is just increasing so rapidly. And none of them, no antipsychotics, most of the psychiatric meds aren't actually approved for use in children. Like, the FDA has not approved the use of Zyprexa to treat, you know, childhood bipolar disorder. Yet, thousands and thousands and thousands of children are being put on these hugely mind-altering medications that have really long-term side effects. Like, there's all these studies coming out right now about how Zyprexa causes obesity and diabetes in a lot of people, and it's very well documented. And they're giving these things to six-year-olds now. And, you know, you look at the state of our education system, and it sure seems a lot easier to give a bunch of kids Ritalin and Zyprexa than to, like, reduce class size, to make sure that school is actually interesting, to engage with people on a human level, to ask what are the societal problems, what are the systemic level problems of poverty and racism and classism and discrimination and, you know, different access and junk food and all the million different factors that contribute to why kids are having a hard time sitting still in class. You know, it's... I mean, I have a friend in New York who works as a therapist, and he is licensed as a psychiatrist, and what he really wants to do is radical therapy with people, but he has to pay his bills, and the job he could get to pay his bills was working at a low-income mental health clinic, you know, which he felt, you know, as far as his politics go, was like a good place to work. If you're going to plug into the mental health field, it seems like it would be a good thing to go work at a clinic that's serving underserved people. But he goes there, and the way that the structure of the day is, he's not allowed more than 20 minutes with any given client. You know, and he's working with moms who have four kids living in a one-bedroom apartment in Harlem, and people who have no money, a lot of illegal immigrants, a lot of people with no rights, no access to any resources. And what does he end up telling them to do? Go see a doctor and get some Prozac. Because he, as one single isolated individual who's the authorized practitioner, he doesn't have the ability to change the socioeconomic safety net. He doesn't have the ability to change their housing situation, to help them find jobs, to figure out, you know, the many, many, many reasons why people in our world are having a hard time adjusting to the pace of modern life that really, I think, go beyond simple brain chemistry.
I want to remind listeners, you're tuned into Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, operating without a license for over 10 years. Also streaming live at www.freakradio.org. My name's the V-Man, and joining me via telephone are Carrie Lamprecht and Ashley McNamara, two members of the Icarus Project, a non-profit community-based support network and underground media project created by and for people struggling with bipolar disorder and other dangerous gifts that are commonly labeled as mental illnesses. I want to let listeners know that we have another phone line open, and if you so desire, you're welcome to call into the studio and ask a question of my phone guests today. The number is area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-FRSC. Ashley, if I could stick with you for a moment, I wanted to hear more about some of the homeopathic remedies, herbal remedies that you've found to be effective in helping you through your struggles.
Sure. I mean, I've had a pretty good history over the last few years of trying a lot of different alternative therapies. And most recently, I ended up starting to go off my medication this April, and I was not planning to go off my medication at all right now. I had tried last summer, and it ended up being a bit of a disaster for various reasons, and so I had told myself I was going to stay on meds for a couple years before I tried this again. But I ended up developing a really horrible rash over about 75% of my body in April. And I went to Western medical doctors, and they told me it was an incurable skin disease with no known cause and no known cure, and it was extremely rare, and there was nothing they could do. I wasn't really satisfied with this answer. And so I went and saw a homeopath that my aunt had worked with and recommended to me. And she and I both did a lot of research independently and discovered that lithium can actually cause psoriasis. It's a pretty well-documented side effect. And we both suspected strongly that this horrible, debilitating rash that was covering my body was largely due to stress and a side effect of the lithium. And so after having this rash for 6 weeks, and it was absolutely devastating and horrible, she had me discontinue my lithium and put me on a homeopathic remedy that would address both my bipolar difficulties and other health problems that I have and hopefully help with the rash. And within a week, the rash had gone into complete remission. And so that was the reason that I started my last foray into alternative medicine, was because I was having this horrible toxic side effect from the medications. And so what I'm doing right now is something called a constitutional remedy. And what that means is within homeopathy, there's sort of two levels of remedy. There's an acute remedy, which is, for example, say someone has bronchitis, you give them a bronchitis remedy. Or, you know, they have poison oak, you give them a poison oak remedy. And then a constitutional remedy is something you take over a long period of time, like say a year, that is designed to help your body work through a lot of different ailments that it's had that were suppressed either by medication or by psychological suppression. And so over the course of several months, different things reemerge for you that your body never learned how to heal. Like for me, as is common for many bipolar people, I have a long history of allergies and asthma and migraines. And these are all things that were treated for a bunch of years by me being given tons of steroids and tons of antibiotics. You know, I was on prednisone like 4 or 5 times a year for terrible allergies. So the homeopathic remedy that I'm taking is, you know, brings certain conditions back up. Like I went through having really bad asthma for 3 weeks, and then my body kind of figured out what to do about it, and I haven't had it since then. And homeopathy works on this principle of triggering things in your body. It's called an aggravation, triggering symptoms that your body has, but then sort of how immunization works, like triggering a certain response in the body that causes the body to learn how to heal itself. You know, and in the case of like an immunization, you get a shot, it triggers, you know, the disease like chickenpox, and then your body creates antibodies for that chickenpox. It's a bit different with homeopathy. But so I've been going through this process over the last few months of having different things within me that have been suppressed come to the surface. I've had to experience them. Sometimes that's beautiful. It's like having my artistic abilities come back after getting off lithium. Sometimes it's really hard, as in having a lot of stuff related to trauma and a lot of psychological stuff come back, and also having allergies come back and various things. But overall, the idea is that it is actually something that is curative and not just a management thing. You know, Western meds, doctors tell you that you can manage your symptoms with medication, but no doctor will tell you that their medications cure bipolar disorder. They would never say that. You know, the party line is that bipolar disorder is a lifelong disease like diabetes, and that you need a steady dose of medicine for the rest of your life to survive it. Whereas the homeopathic view is actually a pretty radical one in terms of believing that a lot of these things, you can actually get to the root imbalance. And over time, the body can learn how to correct the root imbalance. And for me, the homeopathy has really, it's been a really amazing key that's unlocked a lot of things, and I feel like it's sort of the core of what's helping me to deal with my problems right now. But I definitely also am having to rely on other things, specifically like meditation and yoga and making art as coping mechanisms and things that help me to stay grounded in the present and in the world we live in, you know, because, I mean, as different traumas resurface and just as I, you know, I still am going through intermittently some pretty intense emotional states. And when those come up, you know, what I've been trained to do by Western medicine is to be very afraid of myself and to reach for the stop button and to take the antipsychotic medication. And I don't want to do that right now. So instead, I'm using other techniques so that when emotionally extreme things come up, I can say, okay, here I am. I'm in this room. I'm fine. I'm alive. This is going to pass. This has passed 50 times before in my life, and if I can be calm, it'll pass again. Okay, instead of taking a bunch of drugs this morning to make my anxiety go away, I'm going to draw for 2 hours and see how I feel after that. Or I'm going to take a walk, or I'm going to do yoga and focus for an hour. And so incorporating other things into my life that allow me to handle stress and to handle triggers and to respond to my patterns in ways that don't involve medication. And what I'm finding as I do that is that things pass a lot more quickly when they're not escalating because you're panicking about them. You know, if I wake up and I'm feeling really anxious and really wound up, and if instead of panicking and saying, oh God, that means I'm having an episode, oh God, I'm doomed, and instead of doing that, I can say, okay, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to make myself tea, I'm going to make myself eat, I'm going to make myself do yoga and take a walk, and I'll see if this passes through me. Very often, things actually pass through, and they don't become the kind of crises that they were, you know, a few years ago when I wasn't being able to approach things this way. And there are a lot of therapies out there that encourage this. I mean, one that is actually sort of within the range of Western medicine is something called dialectical behavioral therapy, which was developed originally for borderline personality disorder, but it's a set of therapeutic techniques that are used basically to give a person skills, coping skills, so that they can cope with the stress in their lives and with the extreme thoughts that arise in their heads and with self-destructive impulses and with a lot of the things that can happen psychologically that can make life really difficult for someone. And the idea is that instead of taking a drug to suppress those feelings from ever arising, you learn a set of skills to cope with those feelings once they arise.
That's been
a really powerful paradigm for me.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We do have a caller online. He's been waiting. Caller, go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Ashley. This is Timothy in Portland.
Hey.
Can you hear each other?
I kind of want to play the devil's advocate a little bit because I'm looking at an article that came out this morning in The Guardian, and the title of the article is, "A Force Study Says It's No Better Than a Placebo. Is this the end for homeopathy?" And I guess, you know, obviously the gist of that there is that I guess they've done a series of studies, and this is the Lancet Medical Journal in the UK, and they've done a series of studies basically seeming to suggest that homeopathy doesn't work any better than a placebo for any kind of ailment. And I was wondering what you guys had to say about that.
Sure. I would love to respond to that.
Caller, did you want to stay online or do you want to
I can take it off.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question that you brought up. I mean, you know, to play the devil's advocate back to that, there was a series of articles that came out this week in Street Spirit about psychiatric medications, one of which involved a really lengthy interview with Robert Whitaker, who's the author of Madness in America, which is an excellent book about the history of psychiatry in America. And that article pointed to a lot of studies showing that psychiatric drugs, a lot of them when they were initially developed, actually had responses that were barely better than placebos on a long-term scale. For example, that if you had a group of depressed people and you gave half of them, you know, Prozac and you gave half of them a placebo after 6 months, their rates of recovery were very similar. So just to put that out there in terms of the efficacy of studies to predict what's happening and to really be an accurate gauge of whether or not therapies help people. On the other hand, you know, there is definitely a pretty understandable feeling that a lot of alternative medicine can be quack medicine and that it can't be proven or that it's not thoroughly studied or that people don't have to be thoroughly certified to practice it or that there are a lot of reasons why you shouldn't trust it, basically. You know, and this is a super valid thing to think. You know, a lot of alternative therapies, you don't have to have the same kind of certification to practice them. In the case of homeopathy, I mean, it's funny, you know, I asked my homeopath who I work with at the second time I went to see her, you know, and I said, okay, why if this kind of medicine has the potential to help people so much and to be like such a, I mean, honestly, for me, it's felt kind of like a miracle cure. Why aren't more people doing it? You know, it seems kind of crazy to me and there must be some reason, you know. And what she said to me, you know, and you can take this or leave this, but what she said to me was that basically homeopathy is a discipline that there are very few people who are really classically trained in and who are really extensively trained in, and that there are a lot of people who practice it that aren't, that don't have enough education and don't have enough insight into it, and that practice it in a very casual way, and that they really give it a bad name. You know, she was talking about studies that have been coming out recently where homeopaths will say that someone came into their office and because that person was wearing purple, it meant that the remedy they were supposed to take obviously was, you know, insert X remedy, and people reading the energetics of the color fields and a lot of really wooey kind of homeopathy getting crossed with New Age stuff. And, you know, her view was that when homeopathic medicine and a lot of other alternative therapies like acupuncture, for example, that has documented efficacy over a bunch of years for many people, but that there's always a potential for a therapy to get, you know, crossed up with the world of things that are a little bit specious, like New Age medicine, and to not always be effective for everyone. And, I mean, I think that I would definitely say that my experience has been, both with alternative practitioners and with Western practitioners, that they can be practicing the same thing. For instance, I've seen several acupuncturists, and some of them have helped me tremendously and in a way that was absolutely not questionable at all in terms of ending my insomnia and taking my migraines away completely when I'd been having them for weeks. And then I've seen acupuncturists who did absolutely nothing. And, you know, after seeing them, things didn't change for me at all, and it felt like a waste of money. So I think that any therapy has a potential, depending who is practicing it, to be very helpful and also to be very useless.
If any other listeners want to call in and ask a question, again, the number is area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-FRSC in the 831 area code. I want to kind of shift gears a little bit and just get your thoughts on something. It's a common refrain in our society for people to be very insensitive to people struggling with mental illnesses, and or quote unquote, you know, and even in so-called radical communities, you know, you hear a lot of people make jokes or whatever, use insensitive comments about people who are struggling with these issues. For example, on a recent internet discussion board, a commenter wrote, quote, "You should go to a shrink and take an ink blot test and then have yourself committed." How do you feel when you hear comments like this, particularly among other so-called radicals or anarchists?
This is Carrie. I think in any kind of subculture or subgroups of society, you're going to see reflections of the dominant kind of illness, and that's one that plagues the radical anarchist community just as much as any other one, and at times even more so, because sometimes people are a little bit more married to their dogmas than other folks. But these types of really insensitive remarks, or these basic kind of refrains that are just so off base, are really indicative of the societal kind of view of mental illness. And it, as someone who's a radical and an activist, I've spent years in the streets now, out in the streets protesting, and I've run as a street medic and done lots of different aspects of demonstration law, and, you know, I've gone to the big mobilizations in Miami and New York, and, you know, taken part in the kind of grand spectacle of the whole the fight against globalization and repression. And I see radicals acting in such extremely unhealthy ways, and I see myself acting in these ways as well, which are, you go into the streets to have a physical struggle against whatever your ideologies are, and those barricades separating us from the WTO, or those police ranks that are standing, you know, guarding a building or trying to keep people in a perimeter. You know, these are the ways in which our ideas are taking place in front of us in violent confrontation. And it's almost like some radicals see this as the only way in which to fight oppression is to get in the streets and do it with your hands and your feet. And, you know, and for me, it resonates in some ways. You know, yeah, I want people to see that I'm in the streets, I'm putting my body down, and that my beliefs are so much that I would put myself in a position to be arrested, or to do civil disobedience, or to, you know, claim my beliefs as they are, and not to hide. And I think this is also a radical concept in our own, you know, thinking in our minds, that's amazing and it's empowering. But I also see this extreme amount of traumatization and post-traumatic stress disorder that keeps reliving in each person, you know. And as I see activists that I've known over the years as being involved very deeply in activist actions or direct action and stuff, I see people who are really, really hurting inside and depressed and hopeless in some ways. And it's hard to get up and to walk out every day in the world and say, this place sucks. I hate the system. I hate my job. I hate, you know, like, and the list goes on and on and on. But to have the hope and that antidote is really, really, it's rare. But it's also, it's even rarer the longer that you're involved in the struggle. And that's why people, we see people in the radical community burning out. And there's no talk about taking care of each other, or like sitting down and doing some peer counseling, or, you know, like, I saw that that cop hit you in the head. That must feel terrible. You must feel really oppressed. Or like really speaking to these kind of really deep things. And it's kind of machismo to be like, yeah, I was in the streets and, you know, you claim, you know, to be tough. But at the end of the day, we all are alone and we all go home and we all sit with ourselves. And I feel every time I see a police line or every time I see security at an airport, I feel sad. And I'm not alone. I think we all are feeling sad, you know, like, and that's real. But the thing is, in the radical community, there, it's not okay to talk about your feelings or to be like gushy or emo, you know, all these types of connections with the mind and the body. It's really easy to just marginalize them and push them aside because it might invite some dialogue that's uncomfortable, or it might invite a dialogue that brings up the fact that, you know, we are all out there and we're all interdependent. We're not superheroes. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of us cry ourselves to sleep because of the state of the world. And it's really hard to walk around in our skins in the society, and we're at, you know, our country's at war. It's hard to get up every day and to see the hypocrisy and to see how things aren't working, or to see violence or to see racism and homophobia and all these evils in our world, and to be a radical and have an analysis that says that's wrong, and to still keep going and still have faith and hope and mutual aid, and to look in solidarity in other people's eyes, you know, that is radical. But at the same time, as radicals, we're not doing a very good job of it. So I think that the more I see people engaging in these issues, the more their humanity comes out and their interconnectedness. And it's definitely, it's a hard, hard aspect because it's very, very personal. And we wouldn't want ourselves to be attacked for our beliefs or the ways in which we feel things instead of analyze them or think them or take them apart, like we're very much trained to in a scientific kind of model. So that's my answer. I'm going to hand the phone to Ashley to answer as well.
Thanks.
Hey there.
Hi.
So you were asking in terms of why. I mean, I think that there's, you know, something that, you know, we grow up with certain systems of, you know, systems of oppression, you know, and we replicate them within our own relationships, whether or not we are aware of it. And, you know, as far as the whole, you know, comment on the message board of, well, you should just go see a head shrinker and blah, 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 blah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a really common feature of most groups in society to feel a need to ostracize or criticize or make fun of people who are not like them. You know, and whether that's the kids on the playground who are making fun of the one kid with a different skin color, whether that's the corporate executives who are making fun of the one secretary that doesn't shave her legs, whether that's the anarchists who are making fun of the person who is having emotional problems and feeling really sensitive about the world and insisting that they can't be out in the streets or that they need to make a change or that the way things are happening isn't healthy. I think that it's really a fear-based reaction that is drilled into us, which is that it's always appropriate to find an other and to pathologize that other. You know, I mean, it's like where I grew up, you know, the thing to say was, you know, you're so gay, that's so gay, you know, like, and people said that, you know, most of the time, I think, not even really associating in their heads that gay was even meaning gay people anymore. It was almost like it had become a figure speech to them, you know, or the way that people will say, that's so retarded, you're retarded, you know. I mean, I know people who still say that within the world that I'm in, you know, and it's something that in some way our brains, like, detach the actual human beings that we're talking about, who who are given those labels, and they become things to say that make us feel like we're okay. We're within the bounds of what is okay and good and on the right path. And definitely, you're crazy, you know, is another whole area of stigma that, you know, or that's so schizo what you're doing, you know, that is not always so challenged, you know, and it's another way for people to be like, well, I'm okay, I'm all right, you just need to go see the shrink, and to make fun of that process, you know, and to make fun of the process of asking for help, you know. I mean, I think that there's also, I mean, it's interesting, something, I remember when Sasha and I first started the Icarus Project, he got a letter from someone saying that she felt like there had always been this kind of unspoken idea around her that mental illness didn't really exist, and it was just like middle-class college kids with too much money and nothing to do whining about themselves and coming up with neuroses for themselves, and that really if they had anything real to do in their lives, they wouldn't feel like that, and that it wasn't okay to have problems, that the problems weren't real, you know. But like the Icarus Project right now, one of the organizations we partner with is a place called Fountain House, which is in New York City, and it's a mental health clubhouse. And it's for people who've been in the mental health system and are trying to put their lives back together to hang out with each other and talk and get job skills and do non-therapeutic things. And the majority of that community is people of color and people who definitely are not white, college-educated, middle-class people. And they are people who deal with very, very similar things going on in their brains to a lot of college-educated, middle-class white people I know, and very similar things to a lot of anarchist people I know. And there's a commonality of what we experience that cuts across all lines of class and gender and sexuality and race, and it's a myth to think that that's otherwise. Like, I'm not saying that people's stations in life don't hugely affect what kind of trauma they experience and how things play out, but mental health struggles exist in people across all lines, and thinking that you can safely assume that you are outside of the group where that happens or that those struggles aren't real and people need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, it's just, it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help any of us change the world to feel like we're not allowed to be having problems and talking about them.
There's a great lack of resources, particularly for younger folks, students, youth, et cetera, and also for people who do feel alienated from the larger mainstream society, people that are, you know, working on global justice issues or anti-globalization or anti-racist work or anti-authoritarian work, all these different movements. Maybe aside from the Icarus Project, do you know of any other resources that exist for folks dealing with these kinds of issues?
This is Carrie. I'll start off. Well, let's see. Resources that I rely upon in my community. In San Francisco, we have the Mission Mental Health Services, and it's somewhat of a branch of public health. And so I, being someone who works for a nonprofit, being someone who doesn't make a lot of money and I don't have health insurance, I get my services through Mission Mental Health Services. And you can get your medication for free and see a doctor if you are below income bracket or it's sliding scale. And that meant for me that I didn't have to necessarily like totally cold turkey it just because I didn't have a job that allowed me that kind of privilege or whatever. I think that getting basic services is necessary, but I think also that there's a lot of resources out there that aren't utilized and aren't as obvious or otherwise. I think there's a lot of networks of peer or co-counseling that you can look up online. I like to use the internet to find out about a lot of different information, or if my doctor tells me about something or a medication, I like to look it up myself and see the kind of spectrum of information that's out there on something and make my own decision. I don't want him to make that decision for me, or you know, to make it so as that to seem that I only have one option. It's never that way. I also have a Chinese doctor that I see for my health, and I get treated for when I'm in crisis, will go and talk to my Chinese doctor, and he will give me a holistic approach with herbs and acupuncture, and that also works very well for me. And getting set up with an acupuncturist is a hard thing, just like finding a good, dignified kind of doctor can be in any kind of field. And for me, I just started at Kuan Yin, which is a kind of holistic acupuncture clinic in San Francisco. But there's, in a lot of towns here in California, and we're lucky, there's a lot of there's schools for acupuncturists to go to school, or herbology, or different places like that. And if you go to a school, they tend to have clinics that are sliding scale. Or if there's the California Integral Studies Institute here in San Francisco as well. They have different types of therapy that are also sliding scale. So it takes some searching to try to find out what's in each community. And being on the left side of the coast here, we have some more options than I know that people do in, let's say, you know, Iowa. But, you know, everywhere you go, if you look into the types of treatment that, you know, you would like to see, and you look at schools or centers of education or places around you where people are practicing that, it doesn't hurt to go in and just ask questions and to say, what are my options? This is what I go through. And I'm not necessarily saying, going in and saying, I'm a type 2 bipolar, blah, blah, you know, like, that doesn't mean a lot, you know, but it's saying, this is my experiences, this is what I'm going through, this is what I'd like to have happen to my own health. Like, I would like to function on a level where I can get through the day and I can sleep at night and get my basic needs met. That's where you can start. And in the Bay Area here, we have a plethora of choices and different views, different healing methods, including like somatic therapy, body work, massage, all of these, you know, like there's different types of martial arts that some people really, really find helpful. And yoga, there's a myriad of different ways. I think it's just kind of crossing that line of, okay, I'm going to try to empower myself to take care of myself, and taking the first step towards that and looking into other therapies is kind of scary. But if you are not afraid to ask questions and are not afraid to say, I would really like to live in a way that I can, like, I love to sleep at night without having to take a pill or to take a shot of whiskey or, you know, whatever is more acceptable in some ways. you know, that's the first step. I'm going to pass this off to Ashley as well.
Hey there. I just wanted to say a little bit on sort of resources that aren't necessarily treatment-based, but in terms of, like, support resources. I mean, there's an organization called Mind Freedom, which grew out of the psychiatric survivors movement in the 60s and 70s, and it's a national and international organization now. And they identify themselves mostly as a human rights group, but they also offer some support groups and things. And they're based out of Oregon, but they have a really active chapter in San Francisco. And you can find them online at mindfreedom.org. And they are a place that a lot of people turn to. They do a lot of activism around psychiatric abuses and mental health rights. I don't always completely agree with their politics and their views on everything, but they help a lot of people out and help a lot of people to realize that they are not alone in thinking that the system is seriously messed up. Another amazing organization is that's a model that I wish other people would replicate is a place called the Freedom Center, which is in Western Massachusetts, and friends of ours started it several years ago. And it's a very locally based place that tries to offer resources to people dealing with mental health problems in that community. And they have everything from free weekly yoga classes to a weekly support group to they do advocacy. They'll help people to get care. They'll help people with legal issues. They'll help people with disability rights. And it's really brought together a whole community of people, you know, and some people go there just to talk about their problems in the support group, and then some people go there and what they really find help through is doing activist work with them. But it's become a real nexus of information and activity in that area of the country, and I would love to see more places like that exist. Another thing is Carrie and I both are part of a newly formed group called the Bay Area Radical Mental Health Collective, and we're a group of people who meet currently in the East Bay, and work on various projects related to disseminating more information about mental health alternatives and providing more supportive spaces, education, and resources around mental health. And our current project is that we have been facilitating a class through the East Bay Free School this summer. It's a radical mental health class, and we've covered topics ranging from race, class, sexuality, and mental health to psych drugs and their side effects. And our last class is this Tuesday, August 30th, and it's on shamanism and mental illness. And that collective is a really exciting project. It's very much evolving as, you know, people trying to fill the gaps of what they don't see that they want to be out there and coming together and saying, what can we create in our communities that will help serve us? And the next project that the collective is really taking on is starting support groups, starting radical mental health-based support groups in the Bay Area this fall. And if people want more information about that, they should email radicalmentalhealth@lists.riseup.net and see if they can get more info about the collective. But so those are a few resources. I mean, the unfortunate answer to your question, really, it's a question I get a lot. Like, are there other projects doing work somewhat like the Icarus Project or other places to plug in for this kind of support? And the honest answer is no, there are not very many at all. I wish that I could say, yeah, there are all these other people sharing the work we're doing and doing it, and that's fantastic. And there are projects budding in different parts of the country, but overall, there is not a whole lot out there in terms of groups that offer support that is neither super mainstream model nor totally anti-psychiatry, but somewhere in the middle and allowing for complexity.
And again, your website is theicarusproject.net. That's spelled T-H-E-I-C-A-R-U-S project.net. And we're kind of winding down to the end of the program here, and I know that there's a few upcoming events listed on your website. Maybe if you wanted to announce that, or I could announce that as well.
Yeah, sure. I'm trying to think. Well, I know that the mental health class is listed on the website, and as I said, that's the 30th. That's Tuesday of this week. And then I'm actually going to be speaking on a panel sponsored by Mind Freedom in San Francisco, and that's on September 11th, and it's a panel about alternatives to psychiatry. And there's going to be people talking about the use of therapy, the use of acupuncture, the use of EMDR, and I'm going to be talking about homeopathy and meditation in the Icarus Project. And that is open to the public, and again, it's September 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Golden State Psychological Association, I think, in San Francisco. And I think that's it for events that we have right now that we're doing. Yeah, I think that's all I can think of right now.
Well, I really appreciate you both joining me today on Rockin' the Boat, and I'll offer you the opportunity to briefly close on any final thoughts, if there's something we haven't talked about or something really important you want to say to kind of end this.
I'd like to say one thing, which is something that came up for me when Carrie was responding to the question about dangerous gifts, which is just that I don't want our comments to imply to anyone that we don't acknowledge the seriously dangerous and incapacitating potential in emotional extremes and in mental illness. We are not under the illusion that these are conditions that are solely to be romanticized or that they're some genius disease or that it's nothing but beautiful and goodness. However, coming back to that language question, part of why we do encourage the use of words like dangerous gifts is because a lot of the time, if your only option to talk about yourself is words like mental illness, then you don't talk about yourself. And if the only option is so stigmatizing and like pathological, you don't have those dialogues. And a lot of why we're trying to sort of offer up different metaphors and different language is so that people will start talking about themselves, because these things are really dangerous. And if you don't, you know, for me, you know, I'm bipolar, and I have patterns that come back again and again and again if I don't take care of myself. And if I don't talk about them with my community, and if I don't educate my friends, and if I'm not open and honest with people about what I experience, really devastating things can and have happened in my life over and over again. And so a lot of why we're out here is to encourage people and to say that it is okay to talk about these things. And the more you talk about them, the easier it gets. And the more you talk about them, the more people in your community know how to respond, the less stigmatized they feel, the more able they are to answer other people's questions or to ask you what you need, the more they know that when you're depressed, they should drag you out of bed and make you leave the house or cook you food, the more they're able to be truly supportive. And if we don't open up these dialogues and if we don't find language to use that fits us, then we stay silent, and they've won. You know, the more that we're silent and the less that we learn to take care of ourselves, the more that they win. And the more that we all, like, get together as communities and really frankly discuss what's happening and learn how to talk about each other and with each other, the closer we can get towards really making the world we want to see happen. Yeah, and so I think that that's a really important part of this whole thing, is being real about how dangerous and devastating these things can be and using that information to figure out ways to live our lives that really prevent things from getting so horrible.
Really appreciate it. That's going to wrap it up. We're out of time. I've been speaking today with Ashley McNamara and Carrie Lamprecht, both of the Icarus Project. You can find more about them at theicarusproject.net. And again, I'll announce the event. There's a free school class Tuesday, August 30th in Berkeley at the Long Hall Info Shop from 6 to 7:30 p.m. dealing with shamanism and mental health. And also Alternatives in Mental Health, a Mind Freedom Summer Seminar on September 11th in San Francisco. Ashley McNamara, one of my guests today, will be on that panel to explore alternatives to psychiatry and electroshock that people have found useful in coping with emotional and mental difficulties. That's Wednesday. September 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Golden State Psychological Association, 100 North Point in San Francisco. Thanks again for taking time to be with us on Rockin' the Boat.
Thank you. No problem.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today here on Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man. Join me again next week from 3 to 5 p.m. right here at 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Stay tuned, and thanks for listening. And that is going to wrap up this edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Freak Radio 101.1 FM. That was Professional Mind Fuckers by His Hero Is Gone. My name is V-Man. I'll be back next week, 3 to 5 p.m. right here on Friday. Join me then. In the meantime, stay tuned. Thanks for listening.